good afternoon, and welcome to Open Sources Guelph here on CFRU 93.3 FM, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I am Adam A. Donaldson of Guelph Politico, and joining me is...
And Scotty Hertz, and I've just had the most beautiful piece of chocolate cake you've ever seen, and then I knew it was time for the show.
It was so tremendous.
Reminded me of sitting here. It's beautiful.
You will not believe chocolate cake like this.
It's just the best.
Open Sources is CFRU's political and current affairs discussion show, and you can listen to us live here on CFRU every Thursday at 5 p.m. You can also listen to us live online. Go to cfru.ca and click on the Listen Now icon at the top right-hand corner of your screen. And you can listen to us anytime by downloading the Open Sources podcast from Podbean on the Guelph Politicast channel or subscribe through iTunes. Today, we will be talking about the great local debate about online voting. Committee voted to take internet balloting away in 2018 in a very split decision, but will the outcry persuade council to put it back on at the end of the month? And can issues about the voter list be allayed? And then we will talk to a conservative leadership candidate best known for his experience as a businessman, and he's hoping to bring that experience to bear on a conservative-led federal government. And we are, of course, not talking about Kevin O'Leary, but Rick Peterson. He will be joining us live from his office in Vancouver at the bottom of the hour. But first, it was almost this time last week that President Donald Trump ordered a cruise missile strike against an airfield in Syria over that beautiful piece of chocolate cake, starting a shift in policy for an administration that not only seemed to have one directive, don't get involved. Now, Scotty, leaving aside the spicy matter, which we will surely get to, what did you make of Trump's move and his foreign policy directions this week?
Well, initially, doing the research for this, and I was sort of joking around that, and this is no joke, by the way, but I was just thinking, you know, where is Trump getting his policy directors from? And I thought, well, it can't be coming, this honest to God, I was like, it can't be coming from Ivanka or, you know, somebody who was off The Apprentice. And then sure enough, there was the story. It was like, well, Ivanka was so upset by seeing the children being gassed that she went to Dad and said, Dad, you have to do something. So he shoots off a bunch of Tomahawk missiles. Supposedly. I don't know if that's been verified, but she's a senior advisor. You listen to your senior advisors.
So she's a special assistant to the president.
Yeah. So it wouldn't be surprising if this is what happened. And I'm like, you know, it's gotten to the point where the most absurd or nearly absurd thing you can think of is what actually happens. And of course, and the chocolate cake story, which is sort of funny, but it also shouldn't be funny either. And sort of as a bit of an aside, too, just before airtime, I'm not sure if you heard this about the U.S. dropping the largest non-nuclear bomb.
Yeah, I've got that open right here.
The mother of all bombs. Now, it wasn't Syria, obviously.
No. It was in Afghanistan.
It sounds like they're dusting off the arsenal, because that bomb has been around for a long time. I don't think it's ever been used. They use the daisy cutter, which sort of levels. Sounds like it leaves a crater a mile wide and like 10,000 kilograms of TNT or something. It's like, so
yeah,
it sounds like the arsenals are coming out. It's not just Syria and Tomahawk missiles, but North Korea. There's a little bit of a demonstration going on there. We'll call it that. That's putting it lightly, I suppose.
They dropped a GBU-43B massive ordnance air blast bomb, or MOAB, nicknamed the mother of all bombs, and it was dropped on a ISIS target in Afghanistan. The bomb is 30 feet long, weighs 21,600 pounds, and is GPS guided, and Donald Trump called it another successful job.
Yeah, so we'll see how successful it is when they're sort of rooting around the hole in the ground, and you know, it won't just be the ISIS tunnels that have been taken out, obviously. And this is the key problem, among others, but to me, it's, you know, the collateral damage doesn't seem to matter as long as Ivanka's happy or whatever.
Well, the collateral damage is one. The thing about the airstrip is there's a question of, like, was there collateral damage? Did the missiles, like, make their target? Because there's some reports that, like, only half the missiles hit. And apparently they were back flying missions out of that airstrip, like, the next day. So how much damage could they have done?
I'm not sure it was verified, but they must have some kind of missile defense from God knows who, Israelis or...
Yeah, I mean,
somebody's probably given them the technology to shoot.
Well, the Russians were based out
of
there,
of course.
There must have been something. But the thing that bothers me, aside from the collateral damage that you spoke of, was There just seems to be no policy in this. They're talking about a change of direction in foreign policy, and it's like, well, what policy? He got up and talked about how it was so, all these beautiful babies were just killed by this evil dictator, and so I had to do something. And it's like, well, aren't these the same? First of all, aren't these the same beautiful babies you're keeping out of the country with your travel ban policies? Mm-hmm. Second of all, yeah, you launched a bunch of Tomahawk cruise missiles, but what's step two? What's step two after this? It's been a week now. I don't know how we're getting any closer to stopping another incident like that, which happened to spark this last week, another chemical weapons attack perpetuated by Bashar al-Assad, who claimed today that it was on a French TV interview that it was 100% fabricated. The children were fake, which makes Assad sound like the Alex Jones of Syria.
Well, makes it sound like Trump too. Fake news. fake news.
Yeah, so, you know, that's very true.
Those pictures were old.
But his comment about pictures of fake children dying, you know, made me think of Alex Jones, because that was, of course, his allegation about Sandy Hook. But
did Assad turn beet red and go and explode like Alex Jones does on a regular basis?
No.
But that's a measured response.
Yeah. Alex Jones is the Red Hulk. But there's really no sign that anything is happening. He launched a bunch of missiles, and of course the media was like,
oh, they were all over him, eh?
Now he's presidential. Again, he's presidential. He told the generals to push the button, and I don't see someone who's being presidential. I see someone who's trying desperately to just grab at anything. And for someone who hates Barack Obama and Barack Obama's policies so much, Donald Trump loves doing covers of Barack Obama. Because I put the picture on our show notes page of the quote-unquote Situation Room, because it wasn't the real Situation Room. It was the ad hoc Situation Room they've set up at Mar-a-Lago. But it's the
hangout room.
Yeah.
The sunken lounge.
But it's an homage to that picture of the Obama administration.
It was like, would you like another piece of cake? Probably something, right?
But a picture of the Obama administration following the SEAL Team 6 operation to kill bin Laden. And it was just like that. And that's what Donald Trump has been after. And that's what was one of the allegations about that Yemeni mission that went horribly wrong, was that he was trying to have this moment where he could prove what a kick-ass commander-in-chief he is.
It was a Benghazi moment, right?
Right. Kind of. And so it's, again, I don't see any policy here. I see a bunch of theater. I see a bunch of sort of random acts with no overall policy. And then on top of it all, he proves again this week, all you have to do is talk to Donald Trump for 10 minutes and you'll change his mind on anything. He talks to Xi Jinping, Chinese president, who tells him that, gives him a 10-minute, must have been like one of the Coles notes of all times, explanations about the relationship between China and Korea. And he goes, holy crap, that's super complicated. And then he meets with Jean Stoltenberg, Secretary General of NATO, and all of a sudden it's like, you know what, guys? NATO isn't obsolete. So it's again this thing, this feeling that we have that Trump agrees with the last person who talked to him.
And this is it. It's like he's waging a ratings battle rather than any other battle you can imagine. And that's, this is all the stuff coming true that was predicted, that he doesn't really have any policy or any focus. He's got obviously other issues going on that, allegedly, that leads to this lack of focus, because he's just there's no, I sound like I have no focus on it too. I was sort of overwhelmed by the whole thing.
I didn't
thing.
Want to say anything.
But it's not the biggest problem either, because I mean, sticking with Syria, there are so many groups involved in quagmire is the number one word that comes up all the time. There's so many insurgents and rebels and the factions of all stripes, and various players are throwing money at them. The Russians are backing Syria. I saw that vote at the UN Security Council where it's like everybody's on side and Russia uses its veto. If there's anything that needs an overhaul at the UN, it's probably the Security Council. And also the fact this is the exact type of conflict where the UN used to do their thing.
Yeah.
And I think ever since the Balkan conflict, they've been, cut off from doing that for various geopolitical reasons. It just doesn't happen anymore.
Yeah.
Because you used to kind of count on the UN, and now it's like, well, Russia's got this veto. And some of the vetoes are strange, too, right? They're like holdovers from World War II. Like, doesn't France have a veto or something? And it's like,
yeah.
Not that they shouldn't have a veto, but...
Well, it was the original five nuclear powers.
Yeah, so it's just, you know, comedy of the absurd at this point. It's like, well, we want to implement these things because there was a bit of talk about the UN resolution. I think it was in 2015, which was supposed to lead to the peace process 3 years ago in Syria. It's like, we need to get the parties together. We need to talk. And do you remember, like, it was even earlier this year where there was sort of, I'm sure we talked about it too, this peace on the horizon. It's like, we have to have all the players there, even the ones that you don't like.
Yeah, they had ceasefires going. Yeah,
and then boom, it's gone. Just because, and you know, and a move like what Trump made this past week is the kind of thing that could not just, it could tip it over from just being the I was going to use the S word, the show, the chaotic show that it is right now into an even bigger mess. If that's possible, if it's conceivably possible to get worse, Trump will make it worse.
Yeah, and there's been a lot of Monday morning quarterbacking this week, too, about what Obama did in 2013 when the last chemical attack, which, by the way, Trump was also vehemently against, with several tweets about how Obama better not go in there. It's a quagmire. And it's just like,
yeah,
nothing's changed.
And during the campaign, too, it was like, oh, Hillary's going to take us to war. She's going to go into Syria and she's going to do that. And then,
that's very true, too. Yeah.
It's always somebody else. It's never him, is
and I heard somebody make the comment that, yeah, he was enacting Hillary Clinton's foreign policy this week, which, you know, had to hurt.
Hillary's very quietly going, see?
Well, I mean, it had to hurt Trump because, I mean, he's very egocentric that way. He doesn't want to look like he's riffing off other people, even when he's riffing off other people. See my Obama comment from 10 minutes ago. But, yeah, there's the thing is, nothing's changed in Syria on the ground. There's still all these groups. Who are you going to back? You can't back Assad. You can't back ISIS, obviously. And there's sort of various levels in between. And then on top of all this, before the missile attack, you had several different messages coming out of the administration. You had the UN ambassador saying one thing. You had the Secretary of State saying something else. And then you had the president saying something else. This administration is terribly off message, and to the point where it makes you think there is no message, or the message is changing hourly. And of course, there's no better proof of that than the messenger who went so far off script this week, Sean Spicer, talking about Holocaust centers and nobody's gassed people this badly since World War One. And you know, and then he gets up and he can't even, I mean, I understand why the the Holocaust Center and the gassing comments were so bad, but I mean, start from the very beginning, he can't even get Bashar al-Assad's name right. It's always Bassad al-Ashir, some derivation thereof.
Isn't there a whole video of him just mangling people's names?
I'm sure there is.
It is his job to get those names right.
Yeah.
It's part of diplomacy, really. You could forgive somebody maybe once, but if it's your job to know how to deliver, right?
You know what?
That's the kind of communications job that all of us media people would like, a dream job, essentially. Maybe not for Trump, but, you know.
I don't think that's a dream job. In terms of communications job, I think being the White House press secretary isn't a dream job.
Maybe the guy that feeds or person that feeds Spicer the information.
Yeah, being deputy press secretary would probably be
gather all the information.
Job.
And he needs to write things phonetically so he knows how to say them correctly. It's like, what are you doing?
Yeah, it's just I did have some, you know, feelings of, you know, sympathy for him when he was like the communications director and the press secretary at the same time, because those are both full-time jobs. I did have sympathies for him to a point because, yeah, he is the press secretary for Donald Trump. But then again, he accepted the position, so he knew what he was getting himself into. But it's just the basics of it. Yeah. It's Bashar al-Assad. You know, you don't talk about concentration camps and say they're Holocaust centers.
I've never heard that term. Is that code for something?
I don't know, but
it sounds like it.
I don't think it was intentional, but it's
He didn't want to say death camp, or he didn't want to say, you know.
You know, it happens to all of us. So you don't have the exact word at the tip of your tongue. You know exactly what you want to say.
Yeah, but it spelled out pretty quick there. Like,
well, it's true, but in an administration where they didn't mention 6 million Jews dead on Holocaust Remembrance Day, and you have all these accusations of anti-Semitism stemming from the office of the counselor's office, Steve Bannon, who's definitely controversial in his own right now. It's hard not to see the sort of it's not hard not to make those conclusions about anti-Semitism and all that.
Yeah, because when I heard him say it, and of course, yeah, the difficult part to watch is when you see, so no matter who it is, somebody digging that hole and going and deeper and deeper. It's like, this can't end well.
Yeah.
It never ends well who said it about the Hitler? It's been said often about the Hitler comparison.
Yeah.
Once you start comparing stuff to Hitler, that's like, it's almost like your argument is near pointless, because it's the ultimate kind of, you can't pull back from that.
Well, I heard a great point. I think earlier today somebody said it speaks more to our sort of lack of historical literacy that, you know, sort of draw comparison to's in the past.
Hitler's
Hitler.
The worst, and then everything else is kind of...
Yeah, there's, you know, everyone knows about Hitler.
And then somebody will start saying, what about Stalin? You know, just, okay.
Yeah, anyway.
Just take the shovels and hit each other, guys.
Speaking of digging themselves in a hole.
Yeah.
City Council at the Committee of the Whole a couple of weeks ago voted 7-5 to take away internet voting for the 2018 election, even though staff was recommending it and the city clerk's office was recommending not just keeping internet voting, but expanding it up to election day.
Now, were you at that Committee of the Whole meeting?
I was.
And, well, okay, give us the play-by-play. What? You don't have to tell us the players, like, well, so-and-so voted for and against, but...
Well,
was the mood of the room in terms of, like, it was like...
I don't have to, because
overarching...
the people who voted against it are listed several times on the mayor's blog.
Oh, I see.
This is, on top of it all, it's become sort of a political hot potato. The room, I think it happened quite organically, and I think it happened quite surprisingly.
Because there was a lot of lead-in online, there was a lot of chatter about, well, I don't know, this and that, I'm not sure what I'm going to do, and then...
Well, I mean, they weren't proposing anything radical. The most radical thing about what they were talking about was adding these paperless voting machines, which was basically like touch screens that you would go in and you would touch, and away you go. The big change for internet voting was it was going to be up to an election day. What I think the turning came when people started talking about MPAC, which is the Municipal Property Assessment Corporation, which is who tells you what your house is worth, but they also maintain the voters list. And I'm not sure how they got those two jobs, but apparently that's how it's done in Ontario. The voters list for individual municipalities is managed through MPAC.
And of course it's problematic because somebody owns a house, but six students live in it, or...
There's that.
Seven renters living in, and it's like,
or
you
maybe
can't keep track of anybody.
You move into your house, and you know, you have three kids, and they grow up, and then they're living there while they're going to school, and they vote, and then they move out, and maybe they move out of town, out of province, and then you're still getting their voting card.
And, well, didn't Susan Watson say something to that effect?
Yeah.
Like, she's getting a voting card from somebody who's been long...
Yeah.
And I know for a fact I'm still on the voting list in Toronto.
Probably.
Like, and I haven't lived in a Toronto address in about 25 years, but I know for a fact that,
and I'm probably still
551A Bloor Street West. I could vote if I wanted to, right?
But that's the thing, is that, and the point that people were trying to make was that there's no ID requirements for online voting. You get your voter ID card, which gives you a PIN number to vote online. Then all you need is a date of birth, which is probably pretty easy to find if you are using something like, say, I don't know, Facebook. Where a lot of people put their birthdays on Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not so implausible. And Mayor Guthrie, on one of his blog posts, called it, you know, that councillors were feeding fear and conspiracy theories. And it's like, it's not really a theory. You know, a conspiracy theory is something like Roswell. You can't prove that aliens crashed on a New Mexico farm in 1947, or there was a cabal to kill JFK. You can't prove that anyone aside from Lee Harvey Oswald had anything to do with JFK's assassination. Those are conspiracy theories. There is actual evidence, or there's actually a really simple process that somebody can institute to really do this.
Mm-hmm.
And I think people are getting hung up on the Russian comparisons, because that's what a lot of people are talking about, is what happened in the United States with Russia and fake news and all that. And people are like, well, Russia's not going to hack Guelph. It's like, no, Russia's not going to hack Guelph. But it's so impossible to think that anyone might have ulterior motives to hack an election.
When this came up, I was thinking back to the NDP leadership election in 2012. Mm. They had that denial of service attack, and they're running their own little independent election. It really has no massive bearing on the country, let's say, but somebody took the time to mess that up for them, and it screwed up their whole day. And that, I don't, you know, I guess they got it straightened out, but you know, you don't need that. So it's obviously problematic. Now, I can understand wanting to implement, and there are places with machines kind of like the, you know, those old Service Interior machines, which were also tampered with that we don't have anymore. Remember the Service Interior machine?
Yeah.
You got your license or whatever updated. Yeah. It was great. I used to use the one at Stormwood Mall all the time. Gone. Why? Because somebody messed with it to skim PIN numbers. Now, I know some of these digital or electronic voting machines, the potential is there, and they've done it in some places. I think there was a, is it St. Albans in England? Somewhere in England, they you put this voting machine in the town square or whatever. Now, I mean, who's to say you could probably still send somebody else to vote for you? Maybe that's just kind of like voting like proxy. So there, you know, you could, the ins and outs of finding where the problem or the hole is fairly simple, but just because there's been so many issues with them.
Mm-hmm.
And how many people was it? I want to say 13,000 voted online last time, right?
Close enough.
Yeah, and that's a lot. But it's, yeah. Did they ever do any analysis of those voters to see where? I would take it they are mostly younger, and I'm not trying to be ageist or anything, but somebody was implying or saying online about, well, the seniors don't go anywhere, and, you know, maybe it's seniors, but I think it's probably younger people who you want to vote. So I guess the great question is, how do you accommodate them in the digital future? Because the digital now, I guess. Because we know one day, there will come a day where it is just, there is no paper. It's coming. But yeah. I don't know when that day is and when they're going to do a solid on, you know, you just vote with your app, Votee or whatever.
I don't know how good I feel about that because I've sort of been a voice against the internet voting for a while. And
yeah.
And I said this in my Guelph Today column, I find the accessibility argument persuasive.
Sure.
But that's not the argument that is always used. It's always the convenience argument and the young people argument. And those are the arguments you're using, first of all, for the convenience, my point is, why are we trying to make everything in our lives convenient, up to and especially democracy?
Yeah.
You know, it certainly wasn't convenient for the people who fought for democracy.
True.
And then as for young people, go to the CSA website and look at the results of the CSA election, where you have the president of the CSA, the undergrad student government, basically being decided by about 4,000 votes, which is about 25% of the student population, and they have the ballots mailed directly to their U of G mailbox. It's as convenient as humanly possible, because all those kids are on the internet. They have access to the internet up the wazoo. They all have their own computers. And if they don't have their own computers, they can certainly access through the library, one of the numerous computer labs on campus. This is convenience at work, and it's still like pulling teeth to get them to vote for their student government.
And that's the thing. Like, does convenience fix apathy? Of course it doesn't,
no.
Right? Because you don't, if you're just going to shrug it off. I still think it's the kind of thing that involves or needs to have an event around it, or like a physical connection and some kind of excitement too, like that sort of rock the vote. Like, there does need to be some kind of, even if it seems kind of cheesy, something around it to make people go yes, because I don't know how well it's ingrained in people now that, you know, the voting is probably a good thing. And of course, I guess it's always the case in Guelph somewhere where you don't necessarily have a vested interest in the municipal goings on.
Right.
Directly. I mean, there's the buses, of course, so it's not like you're completely detached from it.
But well, that's the shame, is people kind of ignore the local stuff. And,
yeah.
You know, you should be fairly active involved with your student government. You should be going to those annual general meetings and those
for
board
sure.
meetings.
Because it's just the bigger picture and the smaller scale, right? It's
right.
Student government leads to...
And I say that all the time. It's like, you deal with things in a day, 9 out of 10 of them are going to be... You know, you can follow it back to the local government, whether it's like the parks, whether it's rec centers, road maintenance.
Any of the services around this very university.
Exactly. So it's within people's interest to be involved with their local government. But getting back to the online voting thing... what I will say is that the experiment, and it was kind of an experiment in 2014, it seemed to work out okay. I still have concerns because there's no paper trail. I want that physical paper trail.
Yeah.
I remember talking about it on Ballot Box back in the day, like, and maybe it was Rockside or somebody said, like, it would be perfect if there was just, like, you click your vote, and then somewhere in City Hall, it prints it on a piece of paper, and there you go. And, you know, that seems to be the ideal. And it was
the hard copies,
right? And it was kind of the same deal with these screens as well. These touch screens. They want to have paperless voting machines. Like, are they going to print out something?
And that's the thing too. Unless you have somebody there checking the paper and the ink, it's the kind of thing you could be like, "Well, we've got these 6,000 votes, and there's no, you know."
And I want
the
to point
feed
out too,
ran out,
right?
So.
I want to point out too. This isn't just a Luddite thing too. When I was at the Canon, this was 06. Yes, it was 06.
And that was sort of online new media, we'll call it. Not called that anymore.
That was when new media was really new. But yeah, Scott Gilbert, who was my colleague at the Canon, did a little undercover thing to prove that you could vote twice in person at the same polling station just by changing your look. And he got away with it. I mean, they talked to him later, of course, but it was like a full court press sting, and he didn't mark a ballot, the second ballot. He didn't mark it. He just, you know, left it spoiled for obvious reasons. But the system can be gamed. And we have to keep in mind, too, that voter fraud is still like a fraction of a fraction of a fraction of a crime.
Sure.
But at the same time, we don't want to make it easier as well. And I think there's some kind of middle ground here. Some of our local politicians want to make it an either-or scenario, that you have the NIMBYs who are like worried about Russia hacking versus the people who want democracy to be more accessible. I think that is really, really simplistic. And if you go and read like James Gordon's blog or Phil Ault's blog, I think they make quite the compelling complexity case for this. And it's just, I'll be very interested to see what happens on Monday, April 24th, when this comes before council again.
Well, I can think off the top of my head at least two instances in Guelph elections where it was a one vote difference. And that
for sure, even
made
last
as well.
Election.
Yeah, June Hoffman, right?
Yeah.
So, and in my ward, it was Laura Bailey. That was a lot of years ago.
That was about 10 years ago.
Yeah, that's in the scheme of things.
That's a lot. Okay. Before we age ourselves further, we're going to take a break and wait for Mr. Peterson to call in. And then we'll come back after that and with some music and some PSAs. And, of course, you're listening to Open Sources Guelph. Here on CFRU, 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio.
You're listening to CFRU, 93.3 FM in Guelph, your community station.
That was Tyson, local superstar Tyson from the Guelph Theme Songs album by various artists available on Bandcamp. Go to guelphthemesongs.bandcamp.com. Mm-hmm. And someone in this very room is also in this collection, but we'll play that eventually. We'll get
Hint,
there.
It's not me.
Yeah, you get to play your own song. That's what it's all about, getting a show on the station. Yes, indeed. So check it out.
I think it costs, we should probably tell people the cost. It's like $7.
$7, yeah. And all the proceeds go to the Golden Bus Project.
There you go. Yeah.
Where you can go see probably most of these bands. So.
Oh, for sure.
It's a circular thing. So.
Absolutely. And speaking of, well, I don't know if it's circular or not, but we'll go with the segue. We are joined on the line from Vancouver by Rick Peterson. You may know him as the president of Peterson Capital, which is a Vancouver-based company that helps finance and support Canada's leading public and private growth companies. But he is slightly more well-known now as a contender in the federal conservative leadership race. And we are pleased that he took time out of his busy schedule to join us by phone from Vancouver. Rick, you are with us, I take it.
Adam, good to chat with you. Thanks for having me on your program.
We are very happy to have you, too. And as I said in my email to you, I was interested in having you on because I did find a lot of what you had to say at the debate a couple of weeks ago in Toronto appealing, because we've talked about it on this show before. I don't know if you did any research into us, but it's fairly apparent Scotty and I lean to the left side of the force.
Good for you guys.
Appreciate
just,
it.
Just where we ended up.
Just where we ended up. You know. But I did like what you had to say about, you know, reaching out and you know, trying to bring more women, trying to bring more urban professionals, you know, people who do identify to more the center-left side of things into the party, because I've said on this show that what I would like is to see a conservative party I could conceivably vote for as someone who tends to vote, you know, pragmatic center-left. And I did find a lot of what you had to say on that appealing.
Well, thanks, Adam. I don't know, you know, the distinction sometimes we hear of left and right and center, it can be a little bit misleading. I don't even know sometimes where people are referring to. So what I pointed out, I think, Adam, you may have heard in Toronto, was that I'm a fiscal conservative, and my fiscal conservative plan is obviously quite radical in that we want to eliminate corporate income tax or tax for all businesses, and we want to decrease tax on individuals to 15%. So that's very, very straightforward to grow the economy and put more money back in people's pockets. But what I pointed out, Adam, at the event in Toronto is that as a conservative, I happen to hold values and beliefs on the social side that are, you know, if you want to call them left, but I call them progressive. I'm favor gay marriage. I favor and support very strongly, obviously here in Vancouver, LGBTQ rights, and I'm in favor of same-sex marriage, and also the idea of somebody at the end of their life deciding to end their life in assisted suicide under the right conditions. So those are what we would use to call progressive conservative values, and if you couple those with my fiscal conservative values, then you've got my stance, where I come from, and you're right, Adam, our party really needs to attract and keep a support of Canadians in the three major cities. We don't have any MPs, and we have just a few handful of MPs in Quebec. So as a leadership candidate who is fluently bilingual and lives in an urban riding, I strongly believe I'm in the best candidate to try to bring all those things together.
And you're pragmatic, too, which is what I appreciate, because I did note on your website, and this plays into something that was made the news today, the Liberals have announced the plan to implement legalization of marijuana. You said you are not in favor of it yourself, but you understand that this is the road we are heading down.
Yeah, that's right, Adam. In the best of all worlds, it wouldn't happen, but you know what? That ship sailed. Right? That ship sailed, and nowhere more so than in Vancouver. So as we introduce the legalization of it, that's not a slam dunk. This is a very careful situation that you have to do. And have either you and Scotty been to Vancouver recently, Adam?
I have not, no.
25 years for me,
okay.
Sorry. Yeah.
Well, guys, when you come over the Rockies and as your plane lands at YVR, you're going to see a blue haze over the city. And what we have here, guys, is a situation that is out of control because marijuana has not been legalized in Canada. There are designated outlets where, quote, medical marijuana is available, but you guys are in Tim Hortons country. There are more medical marijuana outlets in Vancouver than you guys have Timmy's in Ontario, which is saying a lot.
That means it's one every 20 feet, pretty much.
Yeah, what's essentially happened, guys, is the municipal government here has just turned a blind eye, and it's kind of like a wild west of pot shops. And if you, you know, there's advertising on the windows and neon lights, you know, feeling down, come in for a joint, and there happens to be a quote, medical doctor there that can write you a prescription, and lo and behold, you can buy a couple of joints. So listen, I'm against young people being, you know, criminalized or have a record for possessing a joint, right? That's their call. But what is happening, and this is where the federal Liberals have to be careful, is the regulation and distribution of marijuana has to come under the same guidelines as we currently do with alcohol. And I think they should tax the hell out of it. And I think that the tax revenue should go back into the health system, directly into seniors' care. And that's my position on that. So if that's pragmatic, I'm happy to see it happen. But it's I don't want to have inflicted on the rest of Canada what we have in Vancouver right now, guys.
Yeah, and that's the thing too, I guess, in taxing the heck out of it or whatever, because I guess if you're saying, if I've got you right, you zero corporate income tax would mean that revenue has to come from somewhere, because I think corporate tax last year was somewhere in the range of $40 billion in the economy. I could be wrong on that. I was checking.
No, you're right, Scotty. It is $40 billion.
It's somewhere in that vicinity, right?
Yeah. When I say corporate tax, but you know what corporations are? It's every little small business in Canada, right? Mm. It could be a pot shop, right? It could be a corporation, a dog grooming shop. Any person who engages in a business operation that's not a personal business is a corporate entity. And the reason that my policy team wants to reduce that tax to zero is corporate tax is only 13 cents out of every dollar of tax revenue that comes in. And we want to have people who own businesses. Who's the owner of your radio station? Who owns your radio station?
Well, community radio station.
Yeah, it's community radio. It's public access.
Okay. But your competitors, for example, that have a corporately owned radio station, if they had not to pay corporate tax, most companies would take that money and they'd do a couple things. They would give profits to shareholders who would pay tax. They would increase the salaries of stars like you guys, so that would increase it.
Up from zero, awesome.
There you go. Or they would actually increase the business operation. So what we're doing is we're just following, guys, what Donald Trump is doing. He's taking down the corporate tax in the U.S. from 35 to 15, and it's the absolute number that counts. They don't have a GST there. So for us to compete, if a radio station is looking at setting up in the United States or in Canada, from a tax viewpoint right now, it's way more advantageous to do it in the U.S. So the reason we want to take that corporate tax to zero is to drive investment into Canada, small jobs, small businesses and large. On the flip side of that, the GST is going to go up.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you, because that's quite a significant increase. Was it 5 to 9, I think, was your suggestion? Is that right?
5 to 9. And the average family, though, because of the increase in revenue that's going to be coming from jobs that are available, the average family will make $5 in extra income for every dollar of extra GST that they pay. And the same exemptions that we have are going to stay there. GST is the most fairest tax out there. Everybody pays it. The more you consume, the more you pay, right?
Mm-hmm.
So every economist in the world knows that you tax consumption, you don't tax investment. And to make up for that as well, guys, as well, too, don't forget, we're going to, under my tax plan, your personal federal income tax is a flat 15%.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
I think that, you know, I always hear the word flat tax, and I think that sounds really good in theory. And I want to talk about the 0% corporate tax too, because I think we've seen in recent years we keep cutting the taxes for corporations, but we haven't seen I think a equivalent growth in payment, certainly in terms of remuneration, what people make, that certainly hasn't kept pace. And we've also seen, you know, a lot of corporations kind of sit on assets and not really use them. So, I mean, I know where you're coming from as a businessman, and certainly in your business, which is investing in other businesses. My concern, just speaking as the lowly radio man, is, you know, how do we know that giving corporations that kind of a break is going to yield the results that you're talking about?
You know, I actually have a small business myself here, guys, right? I've got 6 employees. You know, they're across Canada. I pay corporate tax. And what would I do with that money? Would that money sit in my bank account? I don't think so.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Every time I do something with that money, it engenders an activity in the economy that grows the economy and engenders tax itself. We're not doing this to let corporate Canada off the hook.
Mm-hmm.
We're doing this knowing that, and it's being done in Ireland, it's being done in the Baltic states, it's being done in the Gulf, it's being done in the United States. Less corporate tax means more activity in the economy. If you think about what you just said, guys, the corporate tax has continually gone down. Well, why has that happened, right? Why has that happened? That's gone down because we need to drive economy, you know, we need to drive the economy. So on the other side, if a company sits on its cash balance in the real world out there, if you do that too long, two things happen. Shareholders get upset saying, hey, what are you doing with that cash? Give it to us because we own it.
Mm-hmm.
And guess what happens when they do that? Taxes are paid. Or somebody will come along and take the company over for its cash value and fire all the executives. So if you're executive, you don't want to be sitting on big cash, right? The corollary, guys, you guys have heard about the big bailout the Liberals did with Bombardier.
We're going to mention that, actually, because we're curious as to what your opinion would be on that.
Well, the reason that my tax plan is so compelling Scotty, is that zero corporate income tax is the end of corporate bailouts. If you can't make money at zero corporate tax, you shouldn't be in business.
Mm.
Okay?
Mm-hmm. I think, yeah, I mean, that does make sense. I do question, because you're talking from the point of view, and you have six employees, you count as a small business.
Yeah.
And I just think that there is a difference between yourself and you know, the mom and pop, you know, shoe store or burger joint or what have you, and then something like a Bombardier or a Canada Trust, where it is a huge corporate mechanism with thousands of employees.
And your point is?
Well, I just mean that, I guess my point is scale, right? You know, you see an opportunity, whereas, you know, perhaps something like TD sees, you know, profits and ways to pad their bottom line. And
you know, I have two golden retrievers, and I was in the other day. There's a doggy daycare that we take the dogs to when I'm on the road campaigning, and the owner of it came up to me and said, "Hey, Rick, hey, I just saw you on TV." He said, "I saw your idea of zero corporate tax. I love it." I said, "Hey, Fred, what would you do with that money?" He said, "You know what? I'd be expanding in the back. We'd add some more dogs. I'd pay some more staff. It's hard to keep staff. Love your idea." So the scale is actually bigger the smaller the company, isn't it?
I hear you on that. I don't.
Yeah.
I'm not sure we'll agree on the entirely.
Well, yeah.
But I do hear you on that.
I think the word is corporate, guys. Everybody hears the word corporate and says, "Oh God, that's the big corporate."
Yeah, everybody, you know, thinks big when it's corporate, like corporate welfare bums, right? Yeah.
Substitute the word business for corporate. 90% of Canadians work for small businesses.
Hmm.
Very true. Right? I do want to get to another couple of issues as well. And it has to do with, I think, what might be seen as an unpopular stand, at least in conservative circles, is you want to keep the CBC. And more importantly, you want to keep CBC News. You want to pare down the CBC to just the news outlet.
I want to keep CBC, but in a very scaled-down version. So instead of being 260 pounds, I'd like it to be about 15 pounds.
Okay? From a billion to 10 bucks, right? Is that, yeah?
I grew up in northern Alberta. I mean, that was 50 years ago. But CBC has a role in reaching out to Canadians outside of the urban areas.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And to do that, I'm sitting in an office in downtown Vancouver. I can just see out the window of the CBC office from here. I'm probably the most expensive real estate in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. They don't have to be there, right?
Mm-hmm.
They don't have to be there. You guys know better than I do. They can be operating, and they should be, in a small little satellite office in northern Alberta. CBC doesn't have to be in the business of creating terrible docudramas. I won't use an example if we're on the radio. CBC, as much as I love hockey, we all do, CBC doesn't have to be broadcasting sports. In fact, they lost the license to TSN primary. CBC doesn't have to be in national news, because you can get 8 versions of the national news on cable, right? CBC doesn't have to be in many things that they're in. CBC's job and mandate should be delivering regional news, weather, and events, areas outside of urban areas in Canada. That's where they should be doing. And there is a mandate. Second thing CBC shouldn't be doing is being allowed to take in digital advertising,
mm-hmm.
right? They're actually, well, you guys are community operated, but they're actually using taxpayers' dollars to compete against private companies, and that's not fair.
Yeah, it's true, and we do some, we do have some paid advertising here on CFRU, but we are by no means sales-driven. I wanted to talk about, too, before we run out of time, the third plank of your platform, and I do have it on my computer here. You have Strong Economy, which we've talked about, Stronger Party, which we've talked about, Safer Country, and you have spoken quite clear that you're not in favor of any kind of, what am I thinking of here, test.
Well, the Canadian values test. Yes.
Not at all. So you know what I'm going to do, Adam? If you're on my website, which is petersonleader.ca, go to news, okay?
Go to news, all right.
Click on the news, and you'll see media news. Click on news, and you'll see some news releases on the different things that we've got. But if you go down to the second page.
All right.
And sort of Rick Peterson's plan to build Canada together.
Okay, yes, that was top of the second page.
Okay, that's a March 3rd, March 6th release. My goal there is to probably double immigration levels over what they are right now, only under the condition, guys, only under the condition that there are jobs to fulfill these needs. Now, I was in your neck of the woods about a month ago in Belleville.
Oh, yeah.
And a front page story on the Belleville newspaper is they're actively seeking or actively out trying to recruit immigrants to come to Belleville to meet some of the jobs that are available, but also to keep the population growing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So to get back to your guys' kind questions about my economic plan is designed to add $200 billion, which is equivalent of 80% of our budget, into the economy over a three-year period. So that's going to create jobs. My goal is to create jobs. There will be an increasing demand for workers, skilled workers, to come into Canada as there are right now.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So my basic approach is whenever there's a job that can't be met by a Canadian, and let's be careful about this, whenever there's a job that a Canadian cannot, or as we know in the service industries, many Canadians do not want
mm-hmm.
some of the jobs in the service industries, if that's their decision, that's fine, but there are many businesses that thrive and need immigrants to come and work with them, then we should fill those jobs. So there are, and I'll make this very simple, guys, there's three categories of immigration into Canada: business,
mm-hmm.
family reunion, and refugees.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Business immigrants are people who we seek and try to get to come into skilled jobs. So that's where I would like 400,000 at the end of my first term as Prime Minister to come in. Second is family reunification. Those numbers should stay exactly where they are right now, about 70,000 a year. And then the third one is refugees. Current numbers are 40,000. I just probably reduced that down to 30.
Mm-hmm.
And the big difference that I would do there, guys, is I would say it should be not the government bringing it in, but it should be private groups, church groups, community organizations that bring that in. The idea that Kelly Leach has of screening for values is aberrational,
mm-hmm.
is stupid, cannot get done, and sends out a very bad message to the rest of the world. Of course we have values in Canada, guys. We all do.
Sure.
We all have those values. Nobody is disputing that. To screen people for values, to think that you can get answers from people, and people are screened right now. People are screened. Immigrants are screened in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
We screen a large number of immigrants. It's not as if this is something new. But Kelly's approach is a naive one. Kelly's approach is a wrong one. Kelly's approach does not reflect the reality of what's happening and what could be happening. And people are jumping on that to say we have to protect Canada against certain religions coming in. And I just think that that's sending a wrong message. It's short-sighted. It's not something that is realistic. And you know what it does, guys?
Mm-hmm.
It turns us into, our party, as a non-tolerant, as a non-forward-thinking party. And that's why we have nobody elected in our three major cities.
I think that's pretty accurate. And just to say, Rick, you sound like a genuine politician. And I know there's somebody in your race.
Don't say that. There's 14 candidates in this race.
Right.
Well, 12 of them. 12 of them are genuine politicians, right? Full-time
right.
career politicians. And there's two of them who aren't. One of them's name is Kevin O'Leary.
Oh, yeah, we've heard of him.
Yeah.
And Kevin who? No, yes, we do.
There you go.
Yeah.
And the other guy is me. But it's a badge of honor not to not to have been in the political process so far. And the reason I'm in the race is there's thousands of Canadians across Canada who work at the base of the Conservative Party who asked me to step forward. Our campaign's done extremely well. We're very happy with it, and we think we're going to surprise you at the end.
So in your campaign, you've taken some of the other candidates to task a bit on the percentage of the amount of time that they haven't made it to work in the House of Commons. It's
mm-hmm.
it's a range. We won't name names, but I think one was as low as about 10%, and the higher end is closer to 50.
No,
so,
let's name names.
Okay, go ahead. You name the names. I brought it up.
But come on, guys. This is politics.
Can name all 13.
Go to my website.
It was just for the sake of time, because my question to you was, like, is it your plan or your intent to kind of be in Ottawa? I mean, no one could be there all of the time, but you're hoping to overtake those percentages and probably have the lowest percent absence of a leader ever. Sounds like that's your intention.
You know, the key point that I'm making here, guys, is that if you're signing up to become a leadership candidate, right?
Yeah.
If you're a leadership candidate, you can't do the work that you're paid to do. There's no way. We're all going across the country. And so you've made a decision to step up and say, I'd like to be a leadership candidate for the Conservative Party or any party. It's not just us. But you're getting $170,000 a year to do your work in the House of Commons and to do your work back in your constituency. Believe me, all 14 of us are crisscrossing the country. So the noble thing, the right thing to do, would be to say, I can't take taxpayers' money because I'm not doing what I've been asked to do by taxpayers. I'm out campaigning for my leadership race. Once the race is over, if I win, then I'm the leader as an MP, or if I don't win, then I'm back, and then I'll come back on the public payroll. How many jobs do you guys know of in Guelph where you're making $170,000 a year, perks, benefits, pension plan, dental plan, medical plan, disability plan, travel benefits? Can you say to your employer, you know what, I'm going to run for office, but won't be in the office, but just keep sending those checks in, okay?
Well, Rick, unfortunately, we are running out of time, but maybe to wrap up, in terms of, you know, you're coming at this from a very specific point of view as a businessman, not as a politician, as you were saying. So in terms of your best pitch in terms of why Canada needs a businessman to lead it right now instead of a politician, what would you say to persuade people?
You know, I'm a family man. I run a small business. I'm just like the average person out there. The Conservative Party has been sent a message. They need a new voice. We need a new voice, a new face, a new approach. And as a common sense, pragmatic, bilingual person who knows what it's like to meet payroll, that's the kind of approach we need in Ottawa. And for that reason, I'd ask for members' support to put me at number one on their ballot.
Well, I did read a quote that Maxime Bernier is going to put you as number two on his ballot. So I'm not sure if that counts as an endorsement, but...
It's a very strong endorsement. Max is one of the contenders that I really, really admire. They all have good qualities, but Max and I get along well, and I'm flattered by that. Thank you.
Rick, if people want to learn more about your campaign, how can they do that?
The website is petersonleader.ca. And you guys, thank you so much for your time today. I really enjoyed it.
Oh, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Brick. We appreciate your time as well, and good luck with the last couple of weeks of the campaign.
All the best, guys. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Rick. And that was Rick Peterson, Conservative Leadership Candidate, President of Peterson Capital in Vancouver. Not a politician. He made that very clear.
Yes. we'll have to link to the local Conservative Party so they can hear one of their candidates speak.
Ah, excellent, excellent idea.
And if the other 13 are out there listening and available, you know, we're ready. We've got time. Or do we? We don't really have time.
Well, not this week.
That's why I was saying in the interest of time, I couldn't name names because you have to run through 13 names. Deepak, Oprah, and then work down the list. So
yeah. The real trick is doing it in alphabetical order.
We would need about a three-hour show to just cover the
speaking
the names.
Yes. Speaking of talking to conservatives, we will be talking to another conservative next week. Kitchener-Conestoga MPP Michael Harris will be here with us in studio next week, 1 week from today, and we'll be talking about local stuff. Unfortunately, he'll be here a bit too early for the drop of the Ontario budget, which was announced today. It was going to be on April the 27th.
They did that on purpose, right?
Probably. It's all a giant conspiracy. Speaking of April the 27th, that will be our Earth Day show. We're going to have someone from Plastic Free Guelph. We're going to have someone from Transition Guelph in and a couple other community groups. Stay tuned for more information about that. And we will have Ward 1 City Councilor Dan Gibson back for an encore appearance on May the 4th. And we'll be talking about all the local stuff going on, maybe some Star Wars jokes since that will be May the 4th. We're also going to have more guests on in the future. I mean, that's just for the next couple of weeks. Of course, we're going into the summer, so there's going to be more availability of people as, you know, Parliament wraps and Queen's Park wraps for the summer. So stay tuned for all those announcements at opensourcesguelph.com, Open Sources Newswire on Facebook, at @OS_Guelph on Twitter. And, of course, find us on the Guelph Politicast channel on Podbean or subscribe through iTunes to get the podcast version of Open Sources Guelph. You can stay connected with me at Adam A. Donaldson on Twitter or go to guelphpolitico.blogspot.ca.
Scotty Hertz on Facebook, Scotty Hertz on Twitter, and I blog at a spot called The Spanner Book. And yeah, as Adam was saying, if you get in touch with us, you want to be on our show, you know some politicos that want to get out there, operators are standing by. No, just drop us a line.
You know, you could have just, I mean, operator standing by makes it sound like big shots, but no, now you've ruined it. Okay.
We don't give out our cell numbers. Just to certain people.
That's true.
Buddy, that's all, folks.
Anyway, yeah. Have a very happy Easter weekend for those of you that celebrate religiously or not religiously, as the case may be. We'll be back here next Thursday. You can stay tuned for DJ Sounds Good to Me here at the top of the hour on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio, and we will see you with more Open Sources Guelph this time next week.
We'll be right back.